Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharne Nera Vishesha Shunyavadi Pastyutyate Shatarne Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Shivas Adi Gauravakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Vajkavatarubhyas jagripa sindhubhya evacha. Paditana bhavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sri. What a lovely garland, thank you. Well, thank you to whoever made it. It's just beautiful. Sri Ram Nami Mahotsava Ki Jai. Sri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai. Gopremanandi. So we were reading on Sunday coming up to that crucial time when Lord Ram actually kills Ravana. Yeah, we were just about there. I thought I'd give a little bit of detail about that. Interesting little detail. And that Lord Ram, on that last day, Lord Ram confronted Ravana, and they were exchanging some strong words and firing some powerful weapons, this sort of thing. And Lord Ram was firing arrows, which not just arrows, they're in the form of arrows, but they're all empowered by mantras. So they're actually, what they're really called is they're called astras, which basically means something like a divine weapon, something like that. And Lord Ram was firing these arrows or these weapons at the heads of Ravana, because Ravana had 10 heads. But as Lord Ram would knock one head right off the shoulders of Ravana, another head would just pop up just like that. Amazing. And so Lord Ram was firing arrow after arrow, astra after astra, but it was not really having much effect or practically any real effect because there was still 10 heads there. And Lord, but Lord Ram had not fired at the heart of Ravana yet, just at the hands. And like we said, again and again and again and again, at the heads but not at the heart. So the reason why he wasn't firing at the heart was because Ravana, within his heart, was meditating on Sita. Ravana was just completely, what would you say, what's the word, just obsessed with Sita. He couldn't stop himself, he couldn't help himself, he was just attached in a very extreme way. And so this means that Mother Sita was in the heart of Ravana. So, and of course Mother Sita, being a divine transcendental person like Lord Ram, like Krishna, like Radharani, being a great transcendental personality, when you think of such a personality, they are there. So as Ravana was thinking of Mother Sita, Sita was there within Ravana's heart. And just like if we think of Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada is there. If we see a picture of Prabhupada, of Sita, of Ram, of Radha, of Krishna, of Lord Chaitanya, all these very divine transcendental personalities, when we see pictures of them, they're there. They're personally present. In any type of manifestation of themselves. So Mother Sita then was in the heart of Ravana. And therefore, Lord Ram was firing at Ravana's hairs, but not at his heart. But finally, as this was all building up and building up and becoming more and more dramatic, increasingly dramatic, Ravana, because the people on the material platform, and he was, of course, very much on the material platform, people on the material platform cannot stay focused just absolutely and indefinitely forever on anything. They have to, their attention has to go somewhere else, at least from time to time. That's the nature of anything material. Everything material is temporary. And every aspect of material consciousness is temporary. And even though, of course, people become obsessed and can't take their mind off someone or something, but sooner or later they do. Because you cannot stay fixed on the material platform. On the spiritual platform, of course, you can stay fixed. And we want to stay fixed. And we try to stay fixed. Because there's still hangover from material life. Sometimes it's a little difficult to stay fixed in Krishna consciousness, but on the whole, the devotees do pretty much. And as time goes on, as the devotees practice for longer and longer, they become more and more fixed and ultimately just absolutely fixed. So, but Ravana, Even though Mother Sita is the divine mother, transcendental personality, Ravana was not a divine transcendental person. So therefore he couldn't focus even on her. Yeah. So, as this battle went on between Lord Ram and Ravana, and head after head was going and coming, and Ravana's looking around and seeing the devastation and seeing how his side was devastated and becoming more and more devastated. So now he was the last one. Seeing all of that, then Ravana momentarily forgot Mother Sita, even though he was just fixated on her generally. But seeing the devastation, the destruction, and how he was losing everything in that intense material mood of frustration, how I'm failing, and I'm just losing everything. So even though he was so focused on Sita, he momentarily forgot Sita. And at that moment, Lord Ram quickly pulled out the Brahmastra, the personal weapon of Lord Brahma, and fired it at the heart of Ravana. And, well, yes. So we will carry on from that point. Yes. So I'll read a few more verses from the 10th chapter of the 9th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. I'm going to start with verse 22. Lord Ramachandra said to Ravana, "You are the most abominable of the man-eaters. Indeed, you are like their stool. You resemble a dog, for as a dog steals eatables from the kitchen in the absence of the householder, in my absence, you kidnap my wife, Sita Devi. Therefore, as Yamaraj punishes sinful men, I shall also punish you. You are the most abominable, sinful, and shameless. Today, therefore, I, whose attempt never fails, shall punish you." Lord Rama, of course, is the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the Supreme Lord, he's supreme in everything. We know about the six opulences, beauty, knowledge, power, etc. We know about the four special attractive features Krishna has. The greatest beauty is the greatest flute playing, surrounded by the greatest devotees, performing the greatest pastimes. So everything the Supreme Lord does is the greatest. And when the Supreme Lord wants to insult someone, he insults them in the greatest way. So it's pretty insulting, isn't it? "You are the most abominable of the man-eaters." I don't know how you could insult someone worse like that. You could say, "Indeed, you are like their stool." It's just incredible aggression, actually. An incredible insult. "You resemble a dog. You are most abominable, sinful, and shameless." Oh, Krishna, Krishna. Ram, Ram, Ram. Yes, so you can imagine this proud Ravana. He's just almost supremely proud. We we could not really become that proud. Of course, we don't have much to become proud of. But he did have some things to become proud of. At least some things. And he was really proud of them. And to be insulted like that, oh, it must have just burned his heart. And that contributed to his forgetting Sita and just becoming frustrated and angry with Ram and the situation and what's happening and why is it happening, all these types of things. After thus rebuking Ravana, Lord Ramachandra fixed an arrow to his bow, aimed at Ravana and released the arrow, which pierced Ravana's heart like a thunderbolt. Upon seeing this, Ravana's followers raised a tumultuous sound, crying, "Alas, alas, what has happened? What has happened?" As Ravana, vomiting blood from his 10 mouths, fell from his airplane, just as a pious man falls to earth from the heavenly planets, when the results of his pious activities are exhausted. Yes. You know, Srila Prabhupada, this is what happens. People come, they fall from the higher planets down onto this planet. But because they're coming from a higher planet, when they first land, arrive, when they're first born, their first birth after having been in the heavenly planets, that generally they're born in, by our standards, a very opulent and, you know, very highly facilitated situation with all sorts of material facilities and so on at their disposal and just naturally right there and there. Their hands, but when they fall, as when they've landed, then they start going down further. And so you see that with a lot of these people. Prabhupada said that the beetles came from the heavenly planets, but see what happened, at least to some of them. Sure, really unfortunate. Really degraded. So Ravana fell from his airplane, just as a pious man falls to earth from the heavenly planets, when the results of his pious activities are exhausted. Well, you know what it's like when you're exhausted, don't you? So when your pious credits are exhausted, then you may struggle to keep your materially higher position of opulence and fame and all these things. But when you've exhausted your pious reactions, you can try your best to somehow or other keep some wealth, some fame, some beauty, all these things. But just like when you're exhausted, you just can't carry on. So then they just fall down and just become sort of ordinary, useless people. Thereafter, all the women whose husbands had fallen in the battle, headed by Mandodari, the wife of Ravana, came out of Lanka, continuously crying. They approached the dead bodies of Ravana and the other Rakshasas, striking their breasts in affliction because their husbands had been killed by the arrows of Lakshman. The women embraced their respective husbands and cried piteously in voices appealing to everyone. This is now Mandodari. embracing the dead body of Ravana and just crying out to him, although he's already gone. O my Lord, O Master, you epitomize trouble for others, and therefore you are called Ravana. But now that you have been defeated, we also are defeated, for without you the state of Lanka has been conquered by the enemy. To whom will it go for shelter? And let me just read a short purport by Prabhupada, just a couple of sentences. Ravana's wife, Mandodari, and the other wives knew very well how cruel a person Ravana was. The very word Ravana means one who causes crying for others. Ravana continuously caused trouble for others. But when his sinful activities culminated in giving trouble to Sita Devi, he was killed by Lord Ramachandra. And Mandodari continues, O greatly fortunate one, you came under the influence of lusty desires, and therefore you could not understand the influence of Mother Sita. Now, because of her curse, you have been reduced to the state, having been killed by Lord Ramachandra. Oh, was it Saturday or Sunday, one of the days on the weekend, we read another verse which had the same theme. How that particular verse, just maybe I don't know, 10 verses before this or so, was saying how the soldiers of Ravana were killed, were just wiped out by the monkey warriors and bear warriors of Lord Ram. Their lives were shortened because their master, Ravana, had been cursed by Mother, or not actually cursed, here it talks about curse, but in that verse, several or so verses ago, it was said, because of the anger of Mother Sita towards Ravana. So his soldiers were killed, their lives were shortened, because he, as their leader, was sort of attacked, you could say, by the anger of Mother Sita. That's an interesting point, that the warriors of Ravana, they were not involved in the kidnapping of Sita at all. That was just Ravana on his own. And they had no access to Mother Sita. They were not involved, really, with Mother Sita in any way. Perhaps they didn't even see her. But they were servants of Ravana, who offended Mother Sita so drastically. They were servants, and they had to share the future of their master. Even though they were not directly involved in the kidnapping, the abuse of Mother Sita at all, they were just Ravana's soldiers and servants and part of his entourage. But because they were following him, because he was their leader, they had to share in his fate. Therefore, their lives were shortened. As his life was shortened, their lives were also shortened because of the anger of Mother Sita towards him. She was not really angry. angry towards his soldiers and other people, his followers. She was angry with him. So it's an interesting point, isn't it? You've got to be careful who you follow. You've got to be careful who you follow, and you've got to be careful who you accept as a follower. There are connections. These things are interwoven. Just like in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, it says there that the head of state, the king, president, prime minister, that sort of person, the leader of the country, he takes 1/6 of the karmic reactions of the citizens, his or her subjects. And nowadays, you know, you can just imagine, well, you can't imagine really, but at least, you know, some sort of idea can be there of how much sinful activity is going on and how many sinful reactions are being accumulated by the citizens of South Africa, what to speak of America, just anywhere, any country on this planet. The amount of sinful reactions which are being incurred on a daily basis, well, like I said, we cannot actually imagine, but certainly we can understand that it's vast. It's just extremely vast. Therefore, devotees, don't ever try to become the state president of South Africa. Unless the country, you know, has become Krishna conscious, but there's a way to go before that happens. Yeah, but really it's like that. So because they were the followers of a condemned person, the warriors, the soldiers of Ravana, they were the followers of a condemned person, they became condemned. And if you if you're some sort of leader and you have followers who are condemned, then you become condemned. There's so much sort of interrelationship in this material world, and you've got to watch out. Because as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita in the sixth chapter, that you have to learn how to see in action within action, and action within inaction. In other words, it's complicated. You know, if you ever spend or have spent some time on Facebook, you would see on a person's personal page, you know, like what do they do and a few details about their personal lives, and usually it has something like relationships. And if you've seen enough of these things, as many as I have, there are some standard statements that you can make in regards to your relationships, and one of them is, it's complicated. Which is true. You know, Facebook, what can you say? But they got that right. It's complicated. Only thing is, it's much more complicated than they think. So, yeah, as devotees, we have to be careful not to get, at least not to get entangled with the wrong people. You know, when you're working, we understand, obviously, that the great majority of you have to work, and which generally means in 90-something percent of the cases, you're working for some non-devotee or group of non-devotees. So you just got to be careful not to get too entangled. Leave when you go home in the evening, leave your work at work. Don't take your work home. You know, ultimately meaning don't take your work consciousness home and any feeling of sort of loyalty and commitment to the boss. You know, you've got to become your own, you've got to be your own person as devotees. In material situations, we have to remain our own persons and not get sucked into the sort of the whirlpool of material relationships. So that's what happened to those warriors. That's what happened to them. They were not directly offensive to Mother Sita at all. They had no chance to. But they supported, they followed Ravana, who was offensive and who was cursed by Mother Sita. And the followers, even though they're like only remotely related to the actual situation with Mother Sita, but they were implicated. So, yeah. Anyway, ladies, again, we mentioned the other day, in terms of the statement in the other verse, how those people died because of the anger of Mother Sita towards Ravana. And here now, Mandodari, who's a very pious and chaste lady, actually. In fact, she is one of the classic chaste ladies in Vedic history. There's a list of them, the chaste ladies in Vedic history, including Sita, Lakshmi, Devi, and Mandodari is one of the classic chaste ladies. So she she understands that now, because of her curse, you have been reduced to this state. This, it's not even pathetic state of being dead, it's just hopeless, absolutely hopeless, because of her curse. And that was her power. And that is the power of a lady of character. Yeah. You know, I'm sure you know what it's like in material life, particularly in the very westernized version of material life. The young ladies, many of them think they have to sort of lower their moral standards, otherwise they will not be able to kind of get a man. Yeah. So, you know, amongst devotees, generally it's different. But amongst the non-devotees, particularly in the very westernized society, it's definitely sometimes like that. There's absolutely no doubt whatsoever. So that maintenance of chastity and real personal character, quality of character, this is a very important part of life for a lady. And I'll read a couple more verses here about the situation on the battlefield, and then we'll go to focus a little more on the conclusion of the whole pastimes of Lord Ram. So this is again Mandodari. O pleasure of the Rakshasa dynasty, because of you, the state of Lanka, and also we ourselves, now have no protector. And this is a classic. Can you just imagine a wife saying this over the just right now dead body of her husband? By your deeds, you have made your body fit to be eaten by vultures, and your soul fit to go to hell. Because she knew, like I said, she was a very elevated lady. Yeah, she knew who was Ravana and what was his way of life and what sort of future he was creating for himself. Okay, so let's go on to the end when Lord Ram returns. Let's see. And we'll read a few verses because it's really nice. There's some really wonderful things. So when Lord Ram and Sita and Lakshman and everyone came in, or were they just approaching Ayodhya? O King, Lord Bharat carried Lord Ramachandra's wooden shoes. Sugriva and Vibhishan carried a whisk and an excellent fan. Hanuman carried a white umbrella. Shatrughna carried a bow and two quivers. And Sita Devi carried a water pot filled with water from holy places. Angada carried a sword. And Jambavan, king of the rikshas, carried a golden shield. O King Parikshit, as the Lord sat on his airplane of flowers, with women offering him prayers and reciters chanting about his characteristics, he appeared like the moon with the stars and planets. Thereafter, having been welcomed by his brother Bharat, Lord Ramachandra entered the city of Ayodhya in the midst of a festival. When he entered the palace, he offered obeisances to all the mothers, including Kaikeyi. You remember, right? Kaikeyi. She was the one. Yeah, she got it. She got a bit confused there. But Lord Ram doesn't hold it against her. He came and offered obeisances to her. To Kaikeyi and the other wives of Maharaj Dasarath, and especially his own mother, Kaushalya. He also offered obeisances to the spiritual preceptors, such as Vasishta. Friends of his own age and younger friends worshipped him, and he returned their respectful obeisances, as did Lakshman and Mother Sita. In this way, they all entered the palace. Upon seeing their sons, the mothers of Ram, Lakshman, Bharat, and Shatrughna immediately arose, like unconscious bodies returning to consciousness. The mothers placed their sons on their laps and bathed them with tears, thus relieving themselves of the grief of long separation. The family priest or spiritual master, Vasishta, had Lord Ramachandra cleanly shaved, freeing him from his matted locks of hair. Then, with the cooperation of the elderly members of the family, he performed the bathing ceremony, Abhishek, for Lord Ramachandra, with the water of the four seas and with other substances, just as it was performed for King Indra. Lord Ramachandra, fully bathed and his head clean shaven, dressed himself very nicely and was decorated with a garland and ornaments. Thus he shone brightly, surrounded by his brothers and wife, who were similarly dressed and ornamented. Being pleased by the full surrender and submission of Lord Bharat, Lord Ramachandra then accepted the throne of the state. He cared for the citizens exactly like a father, and the citizens, being fully engaged in their occupational duties of Varna and Ashram, accepted him as their father. Lord Ramachandra became king during Treta Yuga, but because of his good government, the age was like Satya Yuga. Everyone was religious and completely happy. O Maharaj Pariksit, best of the Bharat dynasty, during the reign of Lord Ramachandra, the forests, the rivers, the hills and mountains, the states, the seven islands and the seven seas were all favorable in supplying the necessities of life for all living beings. And this is one great classic verse. This is just really, in fact, in Srimad Bhagavatam, it's got to be one of the great classic verses. When Lord Ramachandra, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, was the king of this world, all bodily and mental suffering, disease, old age, bereavement, lamentation, distress, fear, and fatigue were completely absent. There was even no death for those who did not want it. And there's a short purport here by Srila Prabhupada. Let me just read it. It's a very amazing purport. Very, very, very powerful purport. Prabhupada says, all these facilities existed because of Lord Ramachandra's presence as the king of the entire world. A similar situation could be introduced immediately, even in this age called Kali, the worst of all ages. It is said, Kali Kale, Nama Rupe, Krishna Avatar. Krishna descends in this Kali Yuga in the form of his holy name, Hare Krishna, Hare Rama. If we chant offenselessly, Ram and Krishna are still present in this age. The kingdom of Ram was immensely popular and beneficial, and the spreading of this Hare Krishna movement can immediately introduce a similar situation, even in this Kali Yuga. Well, that's amazing, isn't it? All these facilities mentioned, all bodily, mental suffering, disease, old age, bereavement, lamentation, distress, fear and fatigue were completely absent. And there was even no death for those who didn't want it. So, Prabhupada says, a similar situation could be introduced immediately, even in this age called Kali, if we chant offenselessly. And of course, for the devotees, those who are practicing sincerely and seriously, of course it's a question of degree, because we're all on different levels. And this sort of level where anyway, all these conditions appear in your life, this means you're on a high level of Krishna consciousness. And we're not on that high a level, but at least we're on some level, we're somewhere there. If we're chanting our rounds every day, following the principles, doing some service as we're able. So, like we said, it's a question of degree, and to that degree, these different things will be present in our lives. These things will be present in our lives. It's true, even though you can imagine some non-devotee, particularly some kind of skeptical, staunch non-devotee, hearing that when Lord Ram was the king, all these amazing conditions were there for basically everyone. You can imagine how some people would react. They think this is just some, foolishness or something, but it's not. It's definitely not. And we can and we do experience at least many of these things to some degree. And the more we get into Krishna consciousness, then the more we will experience these things in our lives. Okay, there's only, let's see, two more verses. And they're also really important, and they're very instructive verses. Lord Ramachandra took a vow to accept only one wife and have no connection with any other women. He was a saintly king, and everything in his character was good, untinged by qualities like anger. He taught good behavior for everyone, especially for householders, in terms of varnashram dharma. Thus, he taught the general public by his personal activities. So that's the example of Lord Ram. And then the next verse, the last verse in the chapter, is talking about Mother Sita. Mother Sita was very submissive, faithful, shy, and chaste, always understanding the attitude of her husband. Thus, by her character and her love and service, she completely attracted the mind of the Lord. And let me read this purport also. As Lord Ramachandra is the ideal husband, Ekapatni Vrata, Mother Sita is the ideal wife. Such a combination makes family life very happy. Yad yad acharati shrestas, tat tadeve taro jana. Whatever example a great man sets, common people follow. If the kings, the leaders, and the Brahmins, the teachers, would set forth the examples we receive from Vedic literature, the entire world would be heaven. Indeed, there would no longer be hellish conditions within this material world. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 9th canto, 10th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Pastimes of the Supreme Lord Ramachandra. And I know some of you, however many of you, have heard me say this before. My experience on first seeing Srila Prabhupada in Auckland University, New Zealand, sometime in April 1972, there was Srila Prabhupada cruising through the university with a couple of young ladies throwing rose petals in front of his feet and the sweet kirtan going on behind. And this thought just popped into my head out of, I don't know, maybe Krishna, that this must be like heaven. So, yeah, life, there are different places in our literatures in which it is stated that if we live in Krishna consciousness, if we really live in Krishna consciousness, then our situation can actually be like heaven. In the Ishapanishad, we were studying the Bhakti Shastri some months ago, and is it the second verse, I think it's verse number 2, anyway, it's right around there. The speaker says that if we live according to the Ishabhasya system, recognizing everything is owned and controlled by the Lord, not taking more than our quota, and reciprocating for the mercy we get, that way of life. Ishapanishad says that if we live like this, then we can aspire to live for hundreds of years. Just go on living, in other words. Because if you live like that, really in Krishna consciousness, then your life will just be really wonderful. And you'll be really blissful. You'll be really happy. And even though things come up in this material world, you know, some unpleasantness comes from time to time, but you won't really be affected by it. You'll sort of float over the top of it. That's Krishna consciousness. And the more we progress in Krishna consciousness, the more we will get that experience practically in our lives. So let's take this home with us on this Ram Navami day. Let's take this home with us. These last ideas we've just been reading through the last few verses. How, when Ram is really, when Lord Krishna is really in the center of our lives, and we're actually doing our best to keep it like that and to develop it further like that, then inauspiciousness falls away, and auspiciousness just comes, just enters our lives from all sides, and our lives become transformed into something really wonderful, and we become transformed into transcendental personalities at the lotus feet of the Lord. So let us meditate like that, take it home with us, keep it with us, and come back on Sunday, because we will on Sunday, we will have some Hanuman Katha. Hanuman as the great devotee, servant of the Lord, it's nice. Shri Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman Ki, Shri Ram Navami Mahotsava Ki. I believe we have a couple of questions, is it? Or, yeah? Okay. So let's take the questions, and then we'll have Arati. Look at the beautiful altar. Look at that, isn't it wonderful? So nice.
Is Facebook working?
Yes.
Computer crashed and restarted.
We restarted.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. All right, so we've got questions. Someone's going to read them.
Maharaj, how do we overcome our pride? What? Yeah, that's one question.
Okay, that's a good question. It's important to really try to overcome your pride, because In Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada makes the point in relation to the Rasa dance and how Lord Krishna left the gopis in the Rasa dance. The point is there that he left because some pride arose in them that, you know, we have got Krishna. That sort of pride. And Prabhupada says that Krishna can tolerate practically any fault in his devotee, but he doesn't tolerate pride. So how can we overcome pride? Well, you know, if you're capable of it, at least a starting point is to realize, but at least accept in principle, shall we say, that actually I am really a bit of a fool, and I really don't have much to be proud of. Yeah. So, because it's generally, it's true. You know, we don't have some big, big, amazing, wonderful quality which just makes us stand out from the crowd, meaning being recognized by the crowd also, because of that incredible quality that we just have to some wonderful degree. It's not like that. It really isn't like that. So first thing is to accept in principle, you know, that I'm actually a pretty useless person. And then, following that, that to whatever degree my life is auspicious, and of course we're devotees, and we're practicing and trying to progress as devotees, so that's good. That's really good, actually. But whatever auspiciousness has now entered our lives, because we've become devotees, it's only due to mercy. So if I do have some good quality, you know, to some relatively small degree, then it's just by mercy. It's not because I'm intrinsically like that, or from the way I was brought up, I'm like that. It's just that despite us, despite ourselves, Krishna has given us some mercy, and our lives have actually become auspicious. So, yeah, despite ourselves, we can try to accept like this and consider like this from time to time. And then, I would say on a regular basis, pray to the Lord that, my dear Lord Krishna, my dear Srimati Radharani, I know I'm a fool, but the problem is I'm such a fool that I can't really see what a fool I am. Yeah. So please help me to get a more realistic picture of who and what I am, so I can keep my feet on the ground, keep grounded, and not go off into some fairy tale world of thinking that I am Superman, or if not Superman, at least Batman, or Superwoman, or Robin. No, not a Batwoman. Anyway, you know what I mean. You know what I mean. Yeah. That I'm just a fallen conditioned soul, really. And I'm dependent on mercy. And fortunately, I have got some mercy. So my dear Lord, please help me to see myself for what I am and keep in a mood of dependence and humble service so that I keep getting your mercy. That's my suggestion.
The second question is related. What is the difference between material and spiritual pride? How do we identify which of these two we are?
You know, you don't need to worry too much about identifying yourself. You can probably take it that it's not the right kind. But anyway, you're all nice, actually. You're great. But spiritual pride, Prabhupada talked about spiritual pride. Prabhupada said spiritual pride means we have the best Lord and Master. We have the best Master. And we've got Prabhupada. And Prabhupada is the best because he really, really is. This is transcendental pride. But if we start thinking that I'm the best, sure, yeah, that's material pride, yeah. We should always try to be mindful. One devotee said, actually, quite some years ago, but it really caught my attention. The devotee said that Krishna consciousness is so wonderful, it is just uniquely wonderful. And we must get into it and relish it. But we should never forget where we got it from. Yeah, so this type of mindfulness, you know, in material life there's a sort of, would you say, a movement towards mindfulness. It's there, it's going on to some degree. Yeah, just getting off the sort of automatic pilot platform and being mindful of what's the situation. So we should really try to be mindful of, you know, first of all, be mindful, be aware that we're so fortunate and our lives have been improved tremendously through Krishna consciousness. And then always be mindful where we got it from, where we're getting it from, and how we can continue to get it like that. And then we'll, in a natural way, we'll have humility, that's one thing. But we'll also be able to have some spiritual pride in, you know, we have the best process. We have the best mantra, or you could say the best prayer. We have the best songs. You know, our bhajans, they are just completely amazing. You know what I was brought up on? The Beatles, "I Want to Hold Your Hand." We've got the best songs. Really. So like this, mindfulness is an important part of Krishna consciousness. And if we're mindful like that, then we'll avoid the material pride of thinking I'm special, because the only special that I am is I am especially foolish, really. Okay?
How can women improve their chastity?
Well, men can too. Yeah, everyone can. You know, we read actually on Saturday, right at the end, I remember reading what Sita said to Ram, why she should not be stopped from coming with him. And the very last thing we read was that she said that I have never thought of another man within my mind, as do women, who are of low character or something to that effect. So, yeah, you know, the classic understanding of what is chastity in the sort of strict sense is in regard to one's husband or wife. Being chaste like that, and knowing that if your mind sort of goes, you know, dribbling off in the direction of some other member of the opposite sex, that this is just, you know, it's really not being chaste, but it's something which is going to produce, if I allow it, my mind to just go off like that and start contemplating, then it is going to cause me pain. It's going to really cause me pain because I'll be contacting the material energy And at this moment, it may be appear nice because I think, oh, a nice looking member of the opposite sex. But after a little while, the real nature of it will manifest, and great anxiety, and beyond just anxiety, I mean, things can start happening in your life on the basis of that sort of simply just contemplating. Things can start going wrong and hurt you badly. And who wants to be hurt? Nobody wants, no sane person wants to be hurt. So, you know, that's on one side, sort of the negative side, that we don't want to let our minds go off into unchaste areas. On the positive side, well, you know that familiarity breeds contempt in all sorts of ways, just in all sorts of ways. So, towards your spouse, familiarity breeds contempt. And therefore, but, the thing is, your spouse is a devotee. I mean, at least obviously in the devotee family, your spouse is a devotee. And to be a devotee, that's a very special thing. There are not many devotees. There are not many, at least, you know, in sort of relative terms, percentage-wise, out of the human race. The percentage is small. Most of the people just haven't got what it takes to get it, to understand, you know, these crucial points. The vast majority, that they're off in some crazy wonderland of utter rubbish and nonsense. But now you are married to a lady or a man who's one of these few special people who has understood, and understood to the point that they're acting and acting on the understanding and dedicating their lives to living the understanding. So that, you know, that means you've got a rare soul that you are associating with on such a close level. But familiarity breeds contempt. So therefore, my suggestion is that from time to time, and means on a regular basis, take a step back and just consider the good qualities of your husband or wife. You know, they've got some other things too, because we're conditioned souls and they're sort of hangovers from our previous conditioned life. But Krishna consciousness, part of it, a really important part, is we don't get too hung up. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, forget the past that sleeps. So in terms of our relationships, try to overlook the effects of the past which are there in your spouse, which, you know, from time to time, your spouse does something which causes some irritation or even worse. But know that I must overlook these things and really try and appreciate the good qualities, because they're there. They're actually there. And the first part of it is simply that this person is a devotee and has committed their life to being a devotee. That's just such an important, valuable, and wonderful thing. So, These are some thoughts on the subject. Okay.
Hare Krishna Shri Gurudev. From the Gita, we understand that there is no advancement in Krishna consciousness, but no advancement in Krishna consciousness is lost, and that in one's next life, he may be potentially born in a Brahmana family, a family with wealth, etc., to continue on his journey. How do we justify families with an abundance of wealth being misused rather than continuing advancing in devotional life?
You mean devotee families who have wealth and they're abusing it, or just, you know, Bill Gates and people like that?
It says and born in a Brahmana family with wealth.
You mean like a Maharaj family from Durban? Well, you know, one way, one perspective is that it's always possible to misuse facility. You know, just because people have wealth doesn't mean that they were devotees, or yeah, they were devotees in their previous lives by any means. But in devotee families, anyway, it's possible that one is born in a devotee family which is fairly wealthy by our standards. But the people, the family members, they get into extravagance. So that's just, you know, in Krishna consciousness, the danger of becoming influenced by Maya is there. And people can get deviated, people can even just fall down, even from fairly elevated levels of Krishna consciousness, if they allow themselves to become enamored by material, say in this case material opulence. You know, a very nice example of someone who is in such a position but is not affected is Ambarish Prabhu. I think you've probably all of you have met him, a bit at least. I think he's been here twice. And he is a very wealthy person. You know, I would imagine he's more wealthy than all of us sitting here put together. Probably quite a number of times more wealthy than all of us put together. But he is a humble, sincere devotee. And he's given so much. But given so much, yeah, that's important. But his character, he's such a gentle soul. And so sincere in his practice of Krishna consciousness. So, you know, you may have a few million rands, but being proud of your few million rands is almost like a pauper being proud of his penny, because rands are hardly worth anything. It's ridiculous, actually. But anyway, you should always remember that whatever is coming my way, it's the mercy of the Lord. So let me accept it. And live in Krishna consciousness the best I can, in terms of whatever my material type circumstances are.
This is the last one. Uh-huh. Can you kindly explain Vibhishana's seemingly unlimited quality of forgiveness, please? And what can we learn from him?
Yes. Forgiveness. You know, we must do a seminar on forgiveness, actually. We did a seminar on devotee relations, if you remember, a while ago. when the world was normal or something. Yeah, that was nice. Humility. Forgiveness. You know, the Bishan, yeah, okay, but just in general as a principle, forgiveness is very important because if someone offends you, let's say they actually offend you. I was going to say, or you feel offended by them, but let's say they actually offend you. And you know, of course you feel that. And it can be a real shock if someone really offends you. But if you carry that around and you won't let it go, then, you know, the person offended you then, back at that point. But now, you know, they're probably offending someone else. They can't be bothered with you any longer. So, but you are carrying the offense with you by meditating on it and remembering that, oh, he did this or she did that, you know, this sort of thing, and carrying it with us. And it hurts you when you meditate on how you got hurt and what it was that was said or done which hurt. So in other words, by not being able to forgive, you now cause yourself pain. The actual incident is over, but now you're sort of perpetuating the incident by not forgiving. And if you can forgive in Krishna consciousness, and the other person, the offender, sees that you've actually risen above this whole, in a nasty situation, that person, if it's a devotee, if it's a sincere devotee, it'll be a real learning experience for them to see that, wow, you know, even though I was a hurtful nonsense, but this person, this devotee, has such character in Krishna consciousness that they've risen above it. And they're not dwelling on it and harboring a grudge. So I think that's what I'd say at this point. But tune in. We'll have a seminar on forgiveness sometime. Okay?